You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, January 2nd, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Happy New Year, everyone. We are back. And just in time, apparently. My petition of Congress to just pretend they were going to do something while I was on vacation and wait until 12 hours before I returned to the microphone was accepted. Shows you who's got the real power in this country. On the program today to discuss the aversion of the fiscal cliff and the saving of humanity. Ryan Grimm from Huffington Post. Washington Bureau Chief, I should say. Also on the program today, Kwanzaa, turns out, according to some Republican a-hole, fake holiday, as opposed to the other real holidays. You know, when Jesus supposedly got born, and the three kings in the manger, and then all that stuff about the miracle with the oil. Those are all real holidays. Kwanzaa's a fake holiday because humans made it. Also on the program today, rather underreported, but the Senate and the President sign off on our government's ability to spy on Americans in a way that you're not allowed to know about, with results that you're not allowed to know about. In other words, just trust everybody. Except for, of course, those people who are being spied on, but you can't know who they are. And during the fiscal cliff negotiations, it turns out that John Boehner, I don't know how we're going to explain this to the children. I'm going to have to sit my daughter down, but basically said, go F yourself to that kindly old Harry Reid. But more importantly, ladies and gentlemen, you may have heard that story that John Boehner said, go F yourself. Oh, my pristine ears. More importantly than John Boehner being a little colorful with his colleagues, the Republicans in the House basically said to all those people whose lives were destroyed, who's been living without electricity, who have no jobs, who have no homes, who have yet to recover from Hurricane Sandy, basically the Republican Party in the House has said to all those people, literally tens of thousands of people, go F yourself. And in a, I don't know, it's starting to get some attention now, basically because Representative Peter King, Republican, who apparently has taken a break from his Muslim bashing and a little bit worried that he's going to be tainted now because he's associated with the Republican Party, has come out, and he has a lot of constituents who were devastated by Sandy. A lot of constituents out of Long Island, entire communities destroyed. Has said, I wouldn't donate any money to the Republican Party. I mean, I've never seen a guy trying to cover his own arse in such a dramatic fashion. Because he's realizing that his party is full of lunatics who hate New Yorkers. Hate the idea of New York or New Jersey or Connecticut getting any type of relief from this massive devastation. Because, you know, they're Northerners, and the Republican Party is basically a regional party consisting of mostly states that are still waging the Civil War in their own twisted minds. So last week, the Senate approved a $60 billion package to provide relief for rebuilding infrastructure, for helping people who are now homeless, jobless, people without electricity, need mold remediation to get back into their home, whatever it is. $60 billion. I don't even know if that's enough, frankly. But it's something. The House was scheduled to take up the bill. Of course, they immediately halved it. Based upon their calculations, essentially, you take what the Senate has done, you divide that by how big of an a-hole you are, and that figure you get, you then refuse to vote on it and punt it down the road so that you can pretend like you're fiscally responsible. This is after them passing pork-laden bills, corporate giveaways in this fiscal cliff compromise, whatever it is. So it's a twofer for these guys. One, they get to say, F New York. And they also get to say, like, I wouldn't spend money on something like that. Remember, this is the party that nominated a presidential candidate who was supposedly a moderate, saying we should cut FEMA during Sandy. So they basically walked away, leaving this legislation on the table, which means it's got to go back to the Senate. It's got the whole process got to start over again. Who knows where it's going to go from there? So Peter King bravely saying, blah, 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 blah. And basically what he's saying is that, geez, you know what? My constituents may realize that despite the fact they get to chew on all the anti-Muslim chum I throw them, that may not be enough for them when they realize that I'm part of a party that is preventing them from getting relief when literally their lives have been shattered. Good luck with that. If your constituents are stupid enough to buy that, then good for you. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Ryan Grimm. We're going to go through this fiscal cliff deal in a vacuum. It's just, in my opinion, a series of missed opportunities. And also, the big lesson here, there was no, the Democrats didn't win, the Republicans didn't win. No, basically, you have very wealthy people winning and have hopefully set themselves up in their perspective to win again in another couple of months. But we shall see. Let's talk to Ryan Grimm, find out exactly went down. Oh, before we go to Ryan Grimm, I want to say a couple of things. And, of course, I will talk about my holidays and the New Year's. I got a couple of funny stories. I gained so much weight that I literally broke our toilet seat when I got back home just by sitting on it. And, yes, I know. That's not a joke. But that aside, one of the reasons why I gained so much weight was because of a wonderful gift that we got from our listener, Amanda, who sent us just this huge basket of all sorts of amazing foods. I actually, one box of chocolate, I ate most of the box of chocolate and then got more of that chocolate to give as gifts to everybody else because it was so good and managed not to eat those. And I also want to thank Christina Cranberry, who sent me a great album, which I'm psyched to go play. I just got it because it showed up while we were on break. So I want to thank you very much. Thank you for all the wonderful wishes. And we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ryan Grid. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Pleasure to welcome back to the program the Washington Bureau Chief of the, I think people have heard of this, the Huffington Post, Ryan Grimm. Ryan, Happy New Year. Ryan? I can't hear Ryan. Are you there? Oh, hold on for 1 second. Sorry, we're having a little bit of problem here. Ryan, are you there? Hold on 1 second, Ryan. Just bear with us. Ryan, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay,
you got me?
Sorry about that. You know, it's the beginning of the new year, and the tech team is a little rusty. There's certain buttons they forget to press, and...
ringing in the new year, right?
That's right. We're going to start 2013. It's going to start off. It's going to be the year of the technical problem.
Uphill from here.
So, okay. So, Ryan, now I know that you spent your entire holiday vacation probably in Congress hanging out with Luke Russert playing flipping cards in the press room at Capitol Hill. It probably sounded it was probably really romantic in that
playing
old school
quarters
way.
Yeah. You much of a quarters fan?
Oh yeah, sure. I was I went to college. Now of course back when I went to college, we didn't play with quarters, we played with actual gold bullion.
You know what that would be worth nowadays?
Oh God, I know. We really blew it. We spent it all on beer. All right, so let's go through this deal. Before we sort of analyze it, let's just walk through essentially what it was. Now, what's really sort of fascinating to me is that when the deal started, it was sort of because it was passed in the Senate before January 1st, I think, or maybe it passed actually on January 1st at 2 in the morning. I don't know. You tell me. It was a raise in taxes, and then the next day it became a tax cut, right?
Well, the irony is that when it was struck, you know, when the hands were shaken, then at that point it was a tax hike. But you're right, it didn't actually go onto the Senate floor until – the first. So at that point, it became a tax cut. And Jason Lincoln's made a really hilarious point this morning is that so Grover Norquist, you know, told his people and senators, hey, you vote like this is a tax cut. You're safe. You know, I'm not going to ding you for being a tax raiser because you voted for this. I consider this vote to be a vote for tax cuts. Okay, super. What did the people who voted against it do then?
Right, they voted against the tax cut.
I mean, you can't both vote for tax cuts. You know, if a yes vote is a vote for tax cuts, then a no vote, by definition, has to be a vote for tax hikes. So most of the Republican conference, all of the Tea Partiers basically voted for a tax hike, according to Grover Norquist, and Marco Rubio and Rand Paul voted for a tax hike, according to Grover Norquist. So whatever, you know, it just shows us Alice in Wonderland thing that this is driven into.
But after we go through this, I want to get back to that point, because to me, that is really crucial in understanding where the leverage lay with this and why, mm-hmm. in my estimation, this was a missed opportunity. That exact dynamic is really, I think, the point. And I quite frankly think the reason why it happened at the last minute and maybe not necessarily by design, but it certainly was sort of the path of least resistance, was that it creates ambiguity around that vote. So that down the road, everybody can sort of go to their constituents and say it was something that they want it to be. But let's walk through, before we get to that part of the analysis, let's walk through what it is. We have taxes now have been raised on any amount of families of $450,000, or I should say every dollar earned by a family above $450,000. Individuals, $400,000. Mm-hmm. It has gone to the Clinton-era tax rates, right?
That's right.
And then walk us through on capital gains and dividends, because this is where I think there was those of us who feel that income should be treated as income as opposed to special income if you're a rich person.
Yeah, and this was probably one of the bigger missed opportunities that so dividends on New Year's Eve snapped back from 20% or maybe it was 15% or whatever they were. They were snapped back to 39.6%, which is what they were under the Clinton era rates, because they were taxed as at the same rate as income. What Democrats gave Republicans here is now it's at 20%, but only 20% above the 450 threshold that you mentioned. So that's basically cutting dividend taxes in half. And I don't know what your dividend income is, but I don't have much dividend income, and most of the people I know don't have much dividend income because we're not rich.
Right.
And this is a huge tax cut for people like Mitt Romney.
Now we should make it clear too. There's a distinction between capital gains and dividends. Capital gains and dividends are not necessary, or in the past anyways, weren't treated the same. Under Clinton,
that's
like you
right.
say, dividends were 39.6%, for people who were making over, I think the threshold at that time was probably around 250, but, capital gains, I think, were at 20%. And so now dividends were cut back. I mean, again, it's confusing because over the course of 24 hours, the rate shifted three times or two
right.
times, I guess. But it basically, yes, it basically says if you invest in a stock, somehow the income that you make from those dividends is so special and so valuable to society that we're
right.
going to tax it at a lower rate. Now, of course, that's a joke. It's just because rich people have sort of bigger hands on the more important levers, and they wanted to make that money.
Right, and what dividends are, just very straightforwardly, is an extraction of wealth from a company. You know, the common understanding of the stock market is that it's a way that companies raise capital, and then they go out and then they invest in their companies, and they you know, they create jobs and they, you know, make profits, and then the share price rises and, you know, everybody wins. But in fact, that's not the purpose of the stock market. The purpose of the stock market is actually to distribute wealth to shareholders. We can get away from the term purpose even if we want to. It's the function.
Right.
The function of the stock market is to dole out money to owners, and that comes at the expense of consumers and workers. So when it doles out this money, let's say Bain Capital buys a company forces it to take a ton of debt, and then it uses that debt to pay out dividends to its new owners, Bain Capital. It is extracting wealth from the company, and that wealth that they've extracted is now going to be taxed at 20% instead of what it would have been, 39.6%. And it also creates more incentives for these private equity and hedge funds to basically just set up their operations so that they can maximize rich people's tax benefits. A lot of these private equity firms aren't even in the business of searching out the best investment, trying to find the best guy making the best mousetrap. They're actually just pouring through the tax code, trying to figure out ways that they can just game the tax code. If it weren't for that, I don't know what Bain Capital would do.
Right, and of course it starves us from revenues on the actual just pure tax rate side. It also, this is money that could be going to workers into wages that would help the economy in a way that, of course, Mitt Romney, he can only buy one loaf of bread at a time, or even just, one loaf of bread per house or whatever it is. And,
right.
But the fact of the matter is, if this money was ended up in the pockets of wage earners, this money would get back into the economy more. So, contrary to the notion that somehow these, dividends encourages investment that will create new jobs, or, shower benefits on the job creators, and they'll go out and do their godly function of creating jobs. No, it in fact does the opposite. It stifles
demand.
Right.
And the more you incentivize dividends as a form of income, by reducing taxes on them, then the more you encourage companies to give more and more dividends to their executives, and the more dividends they give to their executives, the more inequality we have, and the less capital that the company has, but the more capital that these executives have.
Right, and this is exactly what we have seen since the 80s, is when compensation packages for executives, for board of directors and whatnot, were tied into the stock prices. It also created misaligned incentives, and this continues that problem, in that it creates a misaligned incentive for what is good for the long-term health of the corporation or the company, and I'm including in that is also the benefits that might accrue to a community because you have a company that's working there that's paying decent wages, and the people who run that company who see more benefit in basically the cottage industry that is their side bet on what the company is doing, that is driven less by the long-term plans of the company and more about cutting wages, outsourcing, maximizing short-term profits, so that you can put the cash in the coffers of these companies and they can pay it back to the shareholders.
Right. Just ask any town that has had one of their major companies taken over by Bain Capital or another private equity firm. The private equity firm walks away with a ton of dividends, and the company is left with a ton of debt. The mob calls it a bust out. It's an old school organized crime strategy. There isn't a ton of difference except for the sophisticated terminology, in that the violence used is private security guards and local cops rather than Tony Soprano bashing somebody's head in.
Yeah, that reminds me of Dick Armey, but I guess we'll get to that story later. But So let's move from that. And if people are wondering, why did the Democrats cave on that? I think people have to perceive cave is just such an interesting way in which we use it. It gives the benefit of the doubt to the cavee or to the caver in a way that I don't necessarily buy into. But in another area where they supposedly caved was the estate tax, which has gone up from where it was a week ago, but not nearly to where it was 10 years ago. Tell us what the terms are in that estate tax.
Well, actually, I'm not exactly sure about that. What did it? I'm guessing that it came to.
My understanding is that 40%.
I forgot about it. I reported it, so I should know. Something like 40% for 3 million.
It turned out to be 40% with a threshold of a $5 million exemption. So, in other words, a single individual can give $5 million away upon their death, their estate will. And then every dollar for people making over $450,000, for every dollar over $450,000, and this is where it gets complicated because that becomes income. One would presumably, if you get $5 million, then your income would be over that. But I guess that's tied into your income, is 40%. That's the only one question I had about that, how that came out. It becomes 40%. Under Clinton, the exemption was at $1 million, and then every dollar after that, 55%. And remember, if your husband or wife dies, then you get the full $10 million that two people would be allowed to bequeath. And then presumably over that, everything, if those people were making, and this is where it gets complicated for me, if they're making over $450,000 a year, then they get a 40% tax. I've got to look into that. But the amazing thing about this is we are talking about literally less than 5,000 families this is going to impact in the country,
Right.
If we were at the Clinton levels, it would be closer to 40 million people who would be subject to this. It's stunning.
Right. And so this this came down to the rates versus the estate tax. And Democrats were very public about their willingness to trade the estate tax to get the rate down. You know, McConnell was demanding a $750,000 threshold for on income. Rather than what they ended up at, you know, the four and the 450. So, you know, some Democrats thought that they, you know, had extracted some concessions out of Republicans by giving away the estate tax to get it down from, you know, 750 to 400. Of course, if nothing had happened, you know, it went up on everybody. And, you know, people thought that they could get 250 fairly easily. But here's where it comes back to your original point that it gives too much benefit of the doubt to the caver. I don't think that it was a real cave. I don't think that but enough Democrats to be decisive didn't actually want the threshold set at 250 for rates on income. They were much more comfortable with 4 or 450. And we could get into all kinds of reasons why that is, but I think part of it is social, that this is the world that they live in, you know, where people, a lot of their friends, that's what they make. They make, you know, they make more than 250, but they make, you know, close to $500,000 or $1 million a year. And so and then they still, you know, carp about the price of private school. So, you know, to them, you know, these people making $300,000 or $400,000 a year are not quote unquote rich. And that's one, I think, problem that you have with that inequality creates, because you have these people living in worlds that are just completely different from the people that they're supposed to be representing. So I think that they were happy to kind of get thrown into that briar patch of 400 or 450.
Yeah, I mean, we heard Schumer and Pelosi at one point this year come out with we should make this at $1 million.
And even Israel had a great interview on MSNBC where he's a DCCC chair. They asked him, are you willing to go to, you know, 400, 450? And he said, I'm very willing to go there because, you know, it's a concession we're making to Republicans. And actually, frankly, I think it should be at 400, 450 because, the arguments that I just raised that, you know, you're not rich at 250 in some urban areas, yada, yada, yada. And so, you know, in the same breath, he pretended it was a concession and then conceded himself that he wanted it,
right?
Which means it's not a concession. And Republicans knew that they could yank it out of Democrats easily. Lindsey Graham even said on one of the Sunday shows, he was on with Dianne Feinstein. He said, you know, he was asked if he would do 250. He said, no, why would I do 250? When I know Dianne will do 400 or 450, and he's dead right. Of course, that's how you negotiate. If you know that they're going to give it to you, then of course you're not going to give them more.
Right. And this is, you know, this is the story I think that is being underreported, is that this is not about Democrats and Republicans. This is really just about rich people, you know, getting into a comfort zone with what they want in terms of taxes. This is, you know, I think it's one of the problems with inequality is that, of course, it perpetuates itself. Because your lawmakers become completely oblivious to what the numbers mean. Like, you know, if you're living at 250 in New York City, my gosh, it's almost impossible to send your two kids to a $40,000 a year private school.
And, that's right.
Well, yeah, I guess it is. You can't own your own jet either. So, boo-hoo. But it's... And of course, the other aspect of that is not only does it affect it has an impact on the political sort of economy, has an effect on the real economy too, because then all of a sudden the idea of paying for more expensive things drives up the prices for everybody else and puts a lot of things out of people's reach. And we should say that in terms of these estate taxes, it is about a $375 billion giveaway over the next decade, which people should keep in mind, the chain CPI, which would take anywhere from, depending on how old you are and how many years you're on Social Security, take anywhere from 3 to 10% away of your meager Social Security earnings. It is double the amount of savings that we would have gotten from the chain CPI. And I say that because that's probably still on the table because we got more of this BS to go. But the sequester has been delayed for 2 months under this deal, which basically just means we've punted to where the Republicans have more perceived leverage just because we've allowed them to have a perceived leverage, right, with the debt ceiling.
Right. And this will be fascinating. You know, Obama has for a couple of years now, since middle 2011, vowed that he was not going to negotiate on the debt ceiling again, and said that, you know, this is one of the things that he wants to leave as his legacy, that he is not, he feels like if he negotiates on the debt ceiling, that it changes the nature of the presidency in the sense that the Congress becomes that so much more powerful in the sense that it can hijack the agenda whenever it wants by threatening to default. And he is passionate about defending the principle that that Congress can't do that, and that the power needs to be balanced out between the White House and Congress. He's been saying that privately, we know from, you know, Woodward's book and other reporting, for a long, long time. And you know, the last few months, he's been saying it very publicly and very firmly, and he repeated it last night. And I'd like to, you know, leave him an opening to stick to that. I think he should. It's, you know, you can't run a, you know, an empire like this. You can't run a global economy pretending like you're going to default at any moment. And, you know, he could just say, look, the Constitution gives me the authority to pay the debts. I'm going to hold an auction. Arrest me. You know, what are you going to do? And we've got some.
But didn't he already take that off the table? I mean, didn't he already tell? Didn't Carney already say we're not gonna use any type of constitutional? You know,
Carney said that at a press conference, but Obama has never said it. And during 2011, Obama did get briefed by Cass Sunstein about it. He had Cass Sunstein look into it. Geithner didn't like it because it, you know, creates uncertainty around the auction, and, you know, and at the time Obama really just wanted a grand bargain, so he didn't actually have an incentive to go along with the 14th Amendment argument. But Sunstein didn't say that it was, and this is in Woodward's book too, he didn't tell Obama that you couldn't do it. He said that it wasn't advisable because there's some murkiness around, you know, the title. Would the bonds be legit that were auctioned off? And so it's not an ideal solution, and so they didn't go forward with it. But it was not ruled out. You know, Carney has poo-pooed it for sure. But what else is there? I mean, if you're not going to negotiate and the House is not going to pass it, then, you know, I
Well, the other thing is you cave. I mean, that's the thing, is that, like, I don't know what is – and the interesting
he,
thing
I
is –
I mean, he is – I mean, I really do believe that he – that you know, there aren't many things that he really, I think, feels that passionately about, but the power of the presidency and his legacy is definitely one of them. And, you know, this to me seems like something that he – is willing to lay down for
this, except for he didn't.
People,
but the problem is
himself. You know what
set,
I mean?
But the problem is he set the marker already for himself. And this is putting aside the notion that that you know, I mean, I guess you know my sense about the what must happen inside a presidential administration is that they have these different sort of buckets. Where they think these buckets, we've got to fill up a certain amount of these buckets to create a legacy. You know, we've got the singular legislation, the Affordable Care Act. We've taken care of that bucket. And maybe this is his, you know, process bucket. This is the one where I'm going to leave the presidency in, you know, better shape than I found it as an institution, which I may or may not agree with, you know, whether or not the presidency should have certain powers or not. But that's what they have in there. And, you know, it's sort of sad that that's, you know, he's really passionate about that part of the legacy. It's interesting to me because it seems to me that most of the reporting or the analysis from the left has basically said he was also just as adamant about the 250 threshold and the idea that they were going to kick that, that they punted on that to 400,000 has signaled to the Republicans, that this guy, there is no line in the sand for this guy. And that's why he's going to fail.
It depends on what he's defending. You know, if he's defending entitlement programs, then maybe there isn't a line in the sand. If he's defending tax rates, you know, there might not be a line. But if he's defending his own legacy and the legacy of and the institutional power of the White House, then you know, all bets are off. Maybe there is a line that he's willing to stand on.
I can't wait for the American people to rally around that that part of the process thing. Put everyone to sleep.
I mean, think about it this way: House Republicans respond by saying we're going to like launch an impeachment, you know, hearing over this because you're paying the debts. You know, I can't imagine a less popular thing for them to try.
Oh, I agree.
Impeach you for paying our bills.
I agree. I mean,
I dare you kind of thing.
Although the Republican Congress doesn't, I don't think for the most part, they don't operate on that perspective because the Republican Congress is just interested in what their narrow constituency wants. And I think there's going to be a lot of I would argue that for something around 75% of those members of Congress, and it's probably the ones who voted against this deal, they probably think in their mind, I would get points for trying to impeach the president over this. I mean, frankly, I'm surprised they haven't tried it with Benghazi or, or Bo's video
that.
For Christmas, whatever it is. I think
the White House might welcome that.
Right. Well, I mean, that'll be interesting. All right. So let's keep going through this. The alternative minimum tax is permanently patched. That's more or less a wash. That's been happening, it seems to me, every year. So there's really no change there. And that thing was designed sort of poorly not to index, is my understanding. But the payroll tax holiday is going to expire. It's not really, in my estimation, a tax hike because this was sunset in the same way that the Bush tax cuts expiring was not a tax hike. It's reverting back to where it legislatively and statutorily was supposed to be. There are limits on deductions and exemptions. What can you tell me about PEP and PEAS? I have not been making that much money as of late, and so I'm not too familiar with the personal exemption phase out or the PEAS deduction limitation. Do you know anything about those?
I mean, in broad strokes, it just means that deductions are less valuable. Above that threshold. And so it means a rich person's tax bill is slightly higher. Ari Fleischer yesterday on Twitter said that, you know, if he gets if his deductions are worth a little bit less next year, he's very likely going to reduce his charitable giving. which is, you know, such a heart of gold.
Oh, I know. It's so hard. It's so hard on the guy. I mean, because he's going in almost every day and having to put on, you know, like a little bit of makeup and get in there and talk.
It's hard to get off, that, you know. It's a real pain.
And just the idea that, you know, somebody who's making, I guess, $450,000 is going to have to pay another $6,000 a year. It breaks my heart. And particularly around this time of year.
These are the prices we pay, though.
The only upside in this, the biggest upside, I should say, and frankly, I think it's the only upside. I don't see, well, there's two. You've got tax breaks for low-income Americans, the earned income tax credit, the child tax credit, the American Opportunity Tax Credit are extended for 5 years. You also have a one-year extension of unemployment insurance. So it's going to help out people who desperately need this help. It's the only thing that wouldn't have happened on its own as of January 1st. So it's the only real, it seems to me, get in terms of stimulating the economy and that would otherwise required leverage, right? I mean, because let's get back to this whole point. If the clock had struck midnight and Joe Biden and Mitch McConnell hadn't gotten together, you know, and I don't know, drank a bottle of Dewars or whatever it is that they do and made this deal because they trusted each other because they were, you know, both white and old or something. I don't know what it is. And they hadn't made this deal. Then today, tax rates would have gone up on everybody. It wouldn't have made a difference because we're not going to pay that tax until 2014 in April. So there's plenty of time. Today, somebody could have introduced a bill, whether it came from, I guess, the Senate or the House, and said, we're going to cut taxes on 98% of the American public. And in addition, we're going to put in unemployment insurance. We're going to put in these tax credits. We're also going to put in some debt ceiling legislation, whatever it is. We're going to put it in there. We're going to send it to the House. They're going to amend it, right, to take those things out. It's going to go into conference. The whole thing's going to fail, and everybody's going to blame each other for killing a tax cut. But everybody's going to be inclined to believe that it's the Republicans. Why wouldn't that have been a better situation?
Well, I mean, I think you're arguing what a lot of Senate Democrats, including Reid, argued at the time and are still arguing. You know,
if only one of them could have held up something. If only there was something like a filibuster.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's the, you know, internal party dynamics, you know, leave the power, you know, in these major parties with the White House when they control it. But sure, I mean, Reid could have, you know, he's still the majority leader. But, you know, it played out as it did. But,
Give me the counterfactual, because I know, like, you know, Politico has a big piece on what happens. And let me quote from their piece. The president did not believe the dynamic would suddenly shift in his favor after January 1. In other words, my scenario, the president didn't buy into. He rejected the conventional wisdom in Washington, which I guess I had that conventional wisdom, that all sides would have more flexibility after higher tax rates took effect. Republicans were more likely to compromise after the deadline than before it, the White House concluded.
I don't think that's exactly right. I don't think that's
what we're no more likely to compromise. Okay, so give me the counterfactual. Make the argument.
I think what he was actually thinking, that he didn't want to go over the cliff. That I think is the conventional wisdom that he rejected. Not that he wouldn't be in a better position after. Bargaining position after January 1st, but that he thought the economy couldn't suffer like a week of going over the cliff and getting, you know, the markets getting rattled and all other hell that he thought might breaking loose.
But in real terms, what would have happened? I mean, you had a piece a couple of weeks ago saying that in terms of government agencies were concerned, they were basically going forward, assuming that the sequestration was going to get resolved in one form or another. That's still hanging over our heads, right? I mean, that's just 2 months away. But, I mean, what would have been the impact today in terms of what, you know, dollars in people's pockets that we're not feeling, aside, I guess, from the unemployment insurance and not those tax credits, because those wouldn't be applied for another 14 months or whatever it is. So what would have been the real difference?
You know, I actually think the business tax extenders, you know, a couple hundred billion of which were stuffed into this, were probably played a big role in this. You know, the wind sector would have lost all its tax credits, et cetera. You know, things like that Obama might have been worried about. But in general, I agree with you that the agencies themselves and the Pentagon and the IRS weren't planning any changes in January, and we're going to wait until things played out. So I think he did have a week or two, but I think that's where he and the conventional wisdom kind of split, and so he was pushing much harder for a fast deal.
Let me ask you this question. This is maybe a little bit cynical on my part, so forgive me. And you know, my resolution is going to be starting tomorrow to be less cynical in 2013. I promise.
Let's do it.
But to what extent? Hey, look, there is, you know, so much of this, of what the president thinks, is driven by, we know, sort of the village thinking, let's say, okay, the Washington policy elite, if you will, the big money that plays there, obviously the finance sector, but so much of that is reflected back by a lot of the media, and particularly like the wonkish media. There was a lot of desire to sort of say that the fiscal cliff was a complete, cataclysm, that to cross over it was a cataclysm. Mm-hmm. And there was almost a feeling like, boy, we really got to the worst thing that could actually happen is if the fiscal cliff comes and there isn't something cataclysmic that happens, we're all going to look like we don't know what we're talking about. And it almost seems to me that on some level, this narrative was built up. And then people realize, like, oh, boy, this is going to cost us big in terms of just sort of like the perception of our of what we're, if we know what we're talking about, if we don't make it like we're desperate to avoid this thing.
I think that's right. And maybe hopefully they'll be a little more cautious in the future about making stuff up that has no basis in reality. Maybe they got a scare out of it. Hope, you know, will correct themselves a little bit in the future. I'm not real confident of that, but I think you're right. That was a real risk to kind of the elite consensus.
Well, then I'm changing my resolution. I'm going to stay just as cynical, because apparently that's the only way to be with that. Well, all right. And then the big issue, of course, now is we have the debt ceiling that's going to hit sometime in the next 2 months, right? Or it's already hit, but all of the means in which Treasury avoids the basically that they're having to hold another auction to fund the money that's already been spent by our Congress is going to come, and that's going to be the real scary thing in terms of those of us who are worried that things like Social Security and Medicare are going to be on the table, correct?
That's right. They will be.
You think? Well, I mean, I guess they're already on the table.
Right.
The question is,
they are.
Who's going to have who's going to be knocking it off the table? I mean, based upon what we've seen here, are people saving their powder? Are they keeping it dry? I mean, is there a reason why, you know, were there people, do you have a sense that there were like members of the Progressive Caucus who were like, okay, Social Security and Medicare not included in this punting deal, fine, I will vote for it, I will support it. Because, you know, it seems to me that the Democrats provided all these votes for it in the House. They extracted no political price from the Republicans. It basically allowed the Republicans to vote as they wanted on this, which lets them off the hook. There's no way Republicans lost in this deal, in my estimation, because what did they give up? They didn't even pay a political price for this. So, I mean, is that right? Am I right about that? Because I keep seeing like people saying this is Republicans are paying a price. Well, but how? Who? What political price do Republicans pay? The prices that they is what that they have to give unemployment insurance?
I mean, the argument would be that they have since like the early '80s had a, you know, we will never raise tax rates pledge and commitment and philosophy, and that was broken, and that's a big deal, and that with that broken, they their edifice crumbles. You know, something along those lines. And you know, they certainly did not want to break on that.
But Ryan, tell me this, okay? Give me your sense. Who is that charge is hanging around the neck of a pretend Republican Party? In other words, there's nobody going out there and saying, you know, okay, the majority of Republicans in the Senate, but for those 100-some-odd Republican congressmen, the vast majority of Republicans in the House, they didn't go back on that pledge. They still go back. They don't pay a political price for that. They go back to their constituents and they say, I voted against it. Grover Norquist is not holding it against them. There's no primaries that anybody's going to have to worry about. You know, to the extent that they are paying the price because they broke that, that's completely ephemeral. There's nobody who's actually paying a real price for breaking that tradition of not voting for us. That's all sort of, it seems to me, made up.
Yeah. Right. I mean, but, you know, they made it up and then they stuck to it for a while. So, I think the next argument should be about more brackets. Why is the highest bracket at 450 or whatever it is? Why not have one at a million, another at two, another at three, another at four?
I'd like to see that for the estate tax too.
Raise the rates on those brackets as well.
I think so, and hopefully we'll see that in the future. I mean,
it's possible if they try to come out with some cuts that Democrats will come back with some tax reform approaches, and that's the most progressive tax reform that you could think of.
Yes, I agree. And also on the estate tax. Now, we're not going to see it because, they're owned by the wealthy, too. But that's the best weapon for Democrats to come back at, right, is to say, OK, you want to renegotiate this? Let's do it. Let's raise some of those tax rates on the wealthiest of the wealthy.
Yep.
Well, I guess we'll have to talk in the weeks before that debt ceiling fight to see if you're hearing any ideas of that ilk.
Sad but true. This goes on.
Yes. Well, Ryan, thanks so much for catching us up on it. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right. Ryan Grimm, everybody. Washington bureau chief from the Huffington Post. He sounds a little bit like he's in a daze. Like, I think he's still recovering from this whole thing. Those guys, I wonder if he even had a break. I don't think he slept.
It must just be so exhausting to just... Everything about that seems just ridiculous.
I mean, the beauty is that during the break, I didn't watch any of those cable shows with all the BS that was coming from certain quarters about how this was going to be cataclysmic. Could we avoid it? Blah, blah, blah. Look, there's only the only real implications that were even on the table of being discussed in terms of the economy, it seems to me, with the unemployment insurance, and that's the only thing that would have been in the first week that would have made a difference. Everything else was sort of backloaded for either later in the year or not until people file their taxes. And as far as these, the wind energy subsidies, yeah, I guess. Of course, there was a lot more tax breaks, and we'll go through that in the better half of the program. For corporations that, you know, I'm sorry, I don't think that our economy is the health of our economy is a function of Hollywood getting some tax breaks like they did, or NASCAR. You know, if you build a racetrack, you get a tax break. I just don't think that's where the money was that's going to be generating the cash. I don't buy that. Forgive me for being so cynical. I've already gone back on that resolution anyways. I also went back on my resolution about cookies. I tried to start a diet on the 31st before we went and had dinner at some friend's house and said, I'm going to start right now. No cookies. So I can have cake. I just can't have cookies.
Oh, that's it? There's just no cookies? There's
just no cookies. I'm going to start small. Didn't make it. Didn't do it. Couldn't do it because they had some really nice cookies that I had to. But I don't think that the tax breaks, huge tax breaks for Goldman Sachs, I don't think that's going to really. So I'm a little bit. I think so much with this was Kabuki Theater. There was a lot of it. I really do think that, you know, look, there were reporters who have been reporting on multiple occasions. We heard there deals that are going down. Deals that were being reported that were actually going down. And if you don't think that these reporters, and Ryan Grimm is not one of them, in my estimation, and it's a function of access, and it's a function of where these people see their career trajectories. If you don't think that for some of these reporters, and some that we perceive as center-left or centrists or whatever, if you don't think that there was some value for these reporters to play up the implications of this, you know, and this has been a problem that the left has had for an extended period of time, in my estimation, or those who self-identify, at least, as a center-left or whatever it is that these policy intricacies become the entirety of everything. Because the fact of the matter is to divorce the policy implications of a certain measure or this or that measure and look at it in a vacuum without the notion of politics is to delude yourself, and B, also to get the policy wrong. Because policy is only as good as the outcomes it produces. And if you institute policy A, or measure scientifically only that policy A in a vacuum is going to provide for a better outcome, but ignore the implications and the clear implications and the reality that imposing policy A at this juncture will create policy B inevitably, and policy B will provide for worse outcomes than if you never instituted policy A, then you're deluding yourself. You know, this is Thomas Friedman's like, well, I support the invasion of Iraq, but not for the reasons why the Bush administration is doing it, but I still support the thing. Well, you know what? You're an idiot then. And a lot of these policy people, no, listen, when you're a hammer, everything's a nail. And that also means that you have to say, like, this nail is really important that it be sunk in. And in fact, if this nail's not sunk in, it's going to be a cataclysm. There is value for a lot of these types of people in creating drama around things just by their very nature. I mean, that's why you hear this narrative of Washington can't get along. They can't move forward if we don't have a functioning government. No, we have a functioning government. Right now, it just functions in the way that it's supposed to based upon the way that people have elected people. And so, I don't know. Be skeptical of this stuff. And I don't, you know, from a liberal perspective, this is not a disaster, but that's like saying, I'm rolling down. There's a metaphor here, but I for the life of me, I can't figure it out because I get a head cold. But it basically, all that happened is we took another route, and the potential waterfall is still, you know, half a mile down the road, or down the river. You know, it's just that we have elongated the route to that waterfall. We haven't avoided it, or the cliff, if you want to say. But for me, the cliff really is about cutting Medicare and Social Security.
I listened to the BBC business podcast, and every day during this past week, couple of weeks, they would have guys on from Wall Street and other kind of financial analyst types, and almost always none of them were nowhere near as freaked out or as worried about this thing as the people that you would see on cable.
Of course not.
They're all like, the market's factored it in. Hopefully they'll figure it out, blah, blah, blah. And these are the people.
What markets are we talking about? I mean, honestly, like, you know, what markets are we talking about? We're seeing corporate profits still at basically near records, if not records. The stock market is completely rebounded, and we still have 12 million Americans out of work. You know, this obsession with the markets, I don't even know what markets they're talking about. It's going to do what? You know, we need jobs. I mean, listen, I don't care. At the end of the day, the difference between the 250,000 and the 450,000 is only relevant to the extent that the lack of revenue that is gained, you know, that is the revenue that is lost in between those two cutoff points is used as an excuse to cut social programs down the road. So use that leverage now to put a dent in things like sequestration. I don't know. We will see going forward in the future. I don't know if I'm going to get to that Dick Armey story today, but in the better half of the program, we'll talk about spying. Sort of a wonderful story about a... can you imagine if your brother started Facebook and you complained because someone shared your picture on Facebook that you posted to Facebook? That would be hilarious. Well, that happened. And a couple other stories. Plus, we'll take your phone calls. Want to hear about your holidays. Did you get in trouble because your daughter said something to an in-law about Republicans? And some of your in-laws happen to be Republicans? I don't know. That would be an interesting story. All right, we got to take a break. We'll be right back. Number 646-257-3920. You can IM the show at Majority FM. Folks, holidays, very tough time for people on their finances. We lost a few members. Fortunately, I think a bunch of you people took advantage of the Credo deal. I'm going to be talking to those Credo people soon. Find out, hopefully, maybe we can extend a deal or get a new deal or something like that. But it is still your support that drives this show. So if you can afford to become a member, please sign up at majority.fm. Don't forget that, you know, if you use our Amazon link, we get a little kickback.
You know,
nice during the holidays. You can find that at Support the Show. Just click on it,
you
bookmark
it. Freebie listeners, during the best of shows, you got to hear, you know, all that members-only material that we threw on there. And if those libertarian calls on their own aren't enough to make you become a member, why are you even listening to the show? Just become a member.
There you go. See that? There's Matt. Listen to what Matt's saying. Matt is going to Vegas next week to represent the Majority Report at the Podcast Awards.
I will represent.
This is like the first trip that you've had like out of New York in ages, right?
Well, I went to New Orleans in 2011.
There you go.
So, yes. I didn't leave New York for all of 2012.
There you go, folks. So get this guy like a 36-hour first trip to Vegas ever. We're gonna load him up. We're gonna send him to the roulette wheel with a lot of cash, and we're gonna finance this whole show. All right, folks. See you in the better half.